This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. We have lots of hard-hitting news to cover, and our panel of trumpet writers are ready and eager to tell you all about these stories. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And joining us via Skype from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also in the UK, we have Kieran Underwood.
G'day.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, United States President Donald Trump has had quite a busy week with his first foreign trip. He left Washington, D.C. a week ago today, actually, and then spent Saturday and Sunday in Saudi Arabia, and then Monday and Tuesday in Israel. And the Wednesday episode of Trumpet Hour features an excellent interview between Mr. Hilliker and Brent about Trump's time in the Middle East there during the first 4 days of his trip. If you missed that, I would encourage you to go back and just give it a listen when you can. And for the first few segments of today's show, we will pick up where that Wednesday episode left off. And that is with President Trump leaving the Middle East and traveling into Europe. On Wednesday, the first part of his European tour brought him to Vatican City, where he met with Pope Francis. So to bring us up to speed on what was covered there and what to make of this meeting, we'll go to one of our main Vatican watchers, Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, Donald Trump and President Donald Trump and Pope Francis met for 29 minutes in a private audience on Wednesday morning. This was the first time President Trump has actually met with the Pope in person, and there's a little bit of high stakes. People were wondering how it's going to go, is that some of their relations in the past have been somewhat strained, mm-hmm. just with President Trump coming into office on a pledge to build a wall on the Mexican border, and Pope Francis being one of the foremost advocates for immigration, legal and illegal,
right,
into the United States. And then there was that whole incident on the Mexican border back in February 2006, where the Pope said that anyone who talks about building walls is not a Christian.
Yeah, I remember he said something about Christians are about building bridges, not walls.
He's like, building bridges. He said anyone who builds a wall is not a Christian. And then candidate Donald Trump had responded that he thought that he was being overly influenced by the Mexicans, and almost kind of some of the media coverage was trying to paint it like he was saying that Pope Francis was a Mexican agent.
Wow.
But for this meeting, the officials setting it up wanted it to be on a positive note, and so they scoured their policy of both leaders for areas of convergence and kind of found like three things they more or less agree on that they were able to talk about for this 29-minute private audience. Obviously, the audience was private, but the press release said that they talked a lot about the sanctity of life, meaning like anti-abortion measures,
right,
being as that both President Trump and Pope Francis are against abortion.
Yes.
They talked a lot about religious freedom. I think in particular some of the Obamacare regulations that had made it so Catholic nuns had to pay for contraceptions that were against their religion, that Donald Trump had wanted to get some of those rules overturned, that you don't actually have to pay for health care that you don't religiously believe in.
Right.
And then for foreign policy-wise, the big thing was the persecution of Christian communities in the Middle East. This is something that Pope Francis has spoken out against before, and President Trump had said he kind of wanted to make a big part of his foreign policy.
So having found those three areas of common ground, do you feel that this was actually a positive visit, and was it published as something that just showed unity between the U.S. and the Vatican?
The visit itself seemed to be pretty positive, and there may be some some collaboration between the Trump administration and the Vatican on those three issues.
Right.
But in the bigger picture, as we've pointed out many times before, is that the foreign policy objectives of the United States and the Vatican don't align. Obviously, especially now under a Trump administration, where he's talking about like the America First policy and make America great again, where the with the Pope, who's talking more that like we need global financial authorities to make sure that wealth is redistributed so that the rich don't have too much and the poor don't have too little, and we need global authorities to try to control climate change and all these other things that the he's very much into like transnational institutions, that big supporter of like the European Union, Union of South American Nations, that keep signing up on this, is that he obviously the Catholic Church is it puts itself forward as a universal church. And
right.
In some of the Pope's past writings, he's even said that I don't like the concept of borders as the head of a universal church.
Wow.
And so that really does put him in the Vatican quite a bit of like long-term strategic conflict with the Trump administration. With the Trump administration being more like, okay, we need to look out for our nation first, where the Vatican more being like, I don't believe in borders. I think the Catholic Church should be influence the whole world.
Yes. Yeah, so in some of the larger issues, these two men are really almost like rivals of, in leaders of rival power blocks in a way. What do you think of the broader question of religion as it factors into Mr. Trump's trip here? I mean, it's his first foreign trip, and his first three stops are all really to the seats of the world's three monotheistic faiths. You've got Islam in Saudi Arabia, Judaism in Israel, and then heading to the Vatican for this meeting with the head of mainstream Christianity, really. Do you think that Mr. Trump is intentionally trying to make some sort of, you know, religious pilgrimage here? And if so, what do you make of that?
Well, it is definitely, especially within the United States, I mean, it is the religious voting bloc were by and large big Trump supporters. So that's something he did definitely have to keep in consideration, because especially with his daughter Ivanka is Jewish, and then his wife Melania is Catholic. So he's got family members within at least two of these three major religions. And he did get 52% of the Catholic vote, mostly white Catholics in the Midwestern states, not so much the Hispanic Catholics in Southwestern states. Mm-hmm. But that is something that I've seen quite a bit of news coverage, is just the fact that he does have so many Midwestern Catholic voters that kind of tipped the election for him, people who are kind of torn. They said a lot of these Trump supporters, they do have a good opinion of the Pope. I think Pope Francis's popularity ratings amongst Catholics in the United States is up around 87%. And so he can't play up this past division between him and the Pope too much, because there is several million Catholics in the United States who are favorable to both the Pope and Trump, despite some of their lingering differences.
Hmm. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. Andrew has written an article about this meeting. It's on thetrumpet.com. The article is called "What Did President Trump and Pope Francis Talk About?" So please go to thetrumpet.com and check that out. And after this meeting with Pope Francis, President Trump traveled later that same afternoon to Brussels, Belgium. And that began his tour speaking with European political leaders, which will continue on for a few more days even from now. And to tell us about what to make of President Trump's meeting with these European policymakers, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Donald Trump, I think, really chose to end his European tour with a bang. I guess this is one of his final days. I think he comes back tomorrow. And I think this is easily the most significant part of the whole visit. I'll just read a quick quote from Peter Zeihan. He's one of the many good analysts to have exited Stratfor over the last few years. But he writes, "For all intents and purposes, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the foundation for American security for the past seven decades, ceased existing on May 27th, 2017.
Wow. That's
right.
Pretty hard hitting.
Yeah. And I mean, as we all know, there's been a lot of back and forth over the place of NATO. And that's been there throughout Donald Trump's whole campaign. Even when he was running for president, he was talking about pulling out of NATO, questioning NATO's self-defense clause. And this caused a whole load of upset and consternation within NATO. Then in April, Donald Trump said, actually, NATO's not obsolete anymore. And
yeah, he said that fixed it. So it was.
Yeah, that's right. And Europe just seemed. I mean, they didn't kind of like the implication that he fixed it when really nothing changed, but they all breathed a sigh of relief. And it was like, okay, well, Donald Trump is going to be on NATO's side now. Mm-hmm. That's it. Panic over. I mean, okay, we're probably going to be a bit more wary of being so reliant upon the United States. We'll probably have to speed up a bit boosting our defense spending, but panic over generally. And then there was this big event yesterday to launch a new NATO headquarters in Brussels. And instead of kind of celebrating everything that NATO was about, which is, you know, what was to be expected, Donald Trump just about spent the whole speech bashing European powers for not spending enough. He had to go at them for chronic underpayments. Foreign Policy wrote that his remarks left allies, former officials and longtime NATO experts stunned. But then perhaps the biggest part of this is that he refused to reaffirm America's commitment to Article 5, to the self-defense clause. So he became the first American president since Truman to refuse to say, we are going to defend Europe and we are going to defend our NATO allies. And it's that Peter Zeihan was referring to when he said that NATO has effectively ceased to exist, because now, you know, that's its whole reason. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other things that it does, and it enables allies to coordinate and things like that. But at its core is this defense alliance. Mm-hmm. And if European nations no longer believe they can rely on America for their defense, and I think this has been the final nail in the coffin on that, that does bring an end to that alliance effectively. Now, I don't think Peter Zeihan is saying that NATO is going to fold up and close, that there's going to be any really even sudden break with the past, but that you're looking for now just a drift towards irrelevance and playing a much smaller role in the minds and the planners of Europe. And I also, one of the other things I thought Peter Zeihan made a great point is that this isn't just Donald Trump's policy. And I think it's very easy to, and a lot of people are just condemning him and focusing on him. But Mr. Obama had about the same, a very similar policy. He traces even all the way back to some of the ways Mr. Bush approached NATO in the war on terror. And it's actually really a natural continuation of what these three presidents are doing. And so when Europe are looking at this, they're not looking at it as an isolated, crazy president, the way some try to paint it, making this decision. They're seeing, you know, this has come from the last three presidents. NATO, we can't rely on the United States anymore.
So President Trump's main complaint with the other NATO nations seems to be just that they're not meeting that minimum GDP requirement on defense spending. Is that right?
That's right. And I think when this story gets most interesting is then, you know, he's still going to be continuing to push that, and I think you'll still see European allies trying to do more to meet Donald Trump's obligation on that. And maybe there will be some that think, well, if we spend 2%, they'll commit to our defense again. But what I think most significant here is what happens when European nations spend 2%. Well, one thing is Europe becomes a much more effective military power, mm-hmm. A near peer of the United States. But then more than that, Germany or Europe's dominant economic power then becomes Europe's dominant military power, because if everybody's spending 2% of their economy, the nation with the largest economy has the most military spending. And right. So that would put Germany as Europe's de facto military leader in a way that they're definitely the leader, they're definitely the economic leader, but they're not the biggest military power right now. And that would be a huge change in the dynamics of NATO. And I think what is interesting about this is that Donald Trump's administration is well aware of that. They know that that is the inevitable consequence of spending more than 2%. Politico quoted one of Donald Trump's officials saying that Donald Trump wants Germany to be a leader. They say that they're looking in particular for Germany to take notice of this spending 2%, that they want Germany to take on a leadership role within NATO, within the military, within spending 2%. And both Politico and Peter Zeihan point out what this means. I'll just quote the end of Zeihan's article because it is quite dramatic. He writes that there is zero hope for Poland without tens of thousands of German troops fighting on Polish soil. Considering that currently Germany doesn't have tens of thousands of deployable troops, and even if they did, historically German troops haven't tended to leave Poland after being there, Warsaw-Berlin relations are about to become dizzyingly complicated. Every time the Germans have armed, the result has been a broad-spectrum European war. It is far too soon, he says, to call that inevitable, but unless the Germans prove comfortable with Russian troops within a couple of hundred miles of Berlin, the era of German pacifism is nearly over.
Hmm. So some listeners may say, you know, wait a minute, isn't Mr. Trump right about this? If these countries aren't spending the minimum that they're supposed to spend, then isn't he right to ask them to pay their fair share? And isn't Germany now, you know, repentant and trustworthy? So what would you say to that line of questioning?
I do think he's half right. I think he's right in diagnosing a lot of the problem. I mean, you can go back and look at what Herbert W. Armstrong, who really, you know, who we base a lot of our forecasts on, a lot of what he said and what you know, what he's talked about based on what the Bible says. But you look at what he was saying some of the same kind of things, that Europe's taking advantage of America, mm-hmm. that you know, America is spending all of this money on Europe's behalf, and Europe is a beneficiary from that. And that part of it is absolutely true. So yes, he's correctly diagnosed a problem. But the solution is not, well, let's build up Europe to be a big independent military power, because I think, you know, there has never been a time in the post-war world where you've had Europe be this big independent military power, and certainly never a time where Germany has been the dominant military spender in that power. So you know, you're entering uncharted territories, and I think even somebody who would say, well, Germany's changed, I think they would have to still accept that it's a risk, that we're entering an unknown. And so, yeah, he's diagnosing the problem, but the solution, it would be something different. It's not, well, let's get Europe to be a big power so they can defend themselves.
Andrew, you had a statement.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It would probably be a mistake to just let the Europeans flaunt their treaty commitments, though it also would probably be an easy time to renegotiate some of those treaties to have something less than 2%, because I think the combined NATO spending of Canada, the United States, and Britain and the European Union is enough to counter the threats they'd have to deal with. But that it reminds me, it was the first Secretary General of NATO who was British. That's how he summarized up the purpose of the alliance. He's like, the purpose of the NATO is to keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out. Hmm. And then so you look at that balancing act there, you find that if the Americans go out, well, what the other two things that happen is the Russians come in and the Germans go up.
Wow, so it's a fragile balance that looks like it could very soon be offset. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard and Andrew. Well, President Trump himself, as we just covered, he spent the week in the Middle East and in Europe, but that doesn't mean that he forgot about Asia. He actually made what some are calling a pretty bold show of American naval force in part of the Orient. And to tell us about this, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Yeah, well, while analysts some might say that is it was a bold move, I really don't think it was. This is this freedom of navigation operation, which happened in the South China Sea near some of the disputed islands, really is something that has happened quite frequently during President Obama's time. And it's actually been a number of months since Donald Trump has given the order for this to happen. So actually the last time that a U.S. warship went and did freedom of navigation operations through the South China Sea was in last October. So it was actually during President Obama's term. But this ship, the U.S. Dewey, on Wednesday went through, and it was sailing through a group of islands, which is called the Spratly Islands. And it went close or in the within the 12-mile region of a reef called Mischief Reef. And what the Americans basically want to try and do is put a ship there to say that you don't own these islands, these artificial islands that you've put up there in the South China Sea are not legitimate, and any of the restrictions on how close we can come to your island don't really matter because they're not legitimate anyway. So that's the purpose of them sailing this warship through the South China Sea. And just some of the details behind that, the Spratly Islands are about 200 miles, I think, from the Philippines and about 600 from China. So you have these islands which are terribly far from China and much closer to another nation. So that's why America wants to make sure that those are not labeled as legitimate. But China just issues these responses back saying that every time these warships come through, it undermines China's sovereignty and security interests. That was a quote from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Mm-hmm. And he says that there's indisputable sovereignty over these islands that they've created there. So every time they come through, China says to them, what are you doing? This is our sovereign territory, although we just created it a couple of years ago. And that what the U.S. is doing is illegal or uncouth.
In some ways, it's hard to argue with China's reasoning there, because even if it was illegal, it's a little bit late now to say China doesn't own these. We allowed them to dredge up all this, you know, all this sand from the ocean and fill in these partly submerged reefs, turn them into actual islands, pave over them with concrete and asphalt, build military installments all over them, and then fill those military installations with troops and weaponry. And now we say, wait a minute, that's not yours, China. You know, it seems a little bit late to me. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is. It's getting way too late. And most of the analysts are recognizing this. You can sail through a couple of ships and say you're doing a freedom of navigation operation. But really what's happening is they're sailing ships and then China's just building more islands. I have a couple of quotes from this one analyst who was commenting on it. She says, since it began, this is China dredging sand from the seafloor to vastly expand the size of those pinpricks of coral in 2014. China has built airfields, deep harbors, air defense systems on many features, and deployed advanced fighter jets, despite promises to stop militarizing the area. So, I mean, they promised to stop, and they go ahead with it anyway. America putting a ship through doesn't do anything. He goes on and says, they basically succeeded in their construction projects and are well on their way to having floating bases out in the Spratly Islands. There's very little pushback, and they've had to pay very little cost for doing so. And then right at the end, she says, it is unfortunately now game over. And I think that's pretty much right. You have America trying to do these freedom of navigation operation exercises because that's pretty much what they can do. The only thing they can do without getting into a crisis, which they don't want to get into, they don't want to exert any force, and China just goes, okay, we'll just build some more islands.
So this is the first freedom of navigation patrol under the Trump administration, and it comes during a time when relations between China and the U.S. had been warming quite a bit. Mr. Trump had been really trying to reach out to Beijing to get China to just come on board and help rein in North Korea. So what do you think about this timing? Why is Trump now making this move that could put some serious strains on that fragile reconciliation between China and the U.S.?
Well, I don't know. One of the things is that the Navy commanders there, they want to get a lot more done than the president wants to get done. A lot of the admirals, I remember, reading a lot about, this previously, not recently though, but a lot of them have actually wanted to do a lot more. They've wanted to do a lot more exercises in the South China Sea. And President Obama put a lot of stops to that. Trump, obviously, since he hasn't had any freedom of operation exercises until right now, hasn't really wanted to do any of that. So it probably has gotten a lot of pressure to do something. And this freedom of navigation operation is probably just his token sail through.
Well, thank you very much for that, Kieran. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we'll be discussing today are on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they will be up there very soon if they're not yet. So please stop in to thetrumpet.com to get more information on these stories. We're going to take a break in a moment, but first we'll cover one more story from a country that we try to keep a very close eye on, and that is Iran. Iran just concluded a presidential election, and they re-elected Hassan Rouhani, the so-called moderate incumbent, who first became Iran's president back in 2013. And the Washington Post called Rouhani's re-election, quote, a devastating blow to Iran's conservatives. The Guardian labeled it, quote, a huge victory for reformists. So a lot of liberals are very optimistic about this re-election, but the truth may not be so simple. For this story, we'll go to our man in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it certainly is very interesting how this was reported. And I think even CNN, they said that this win for Rouhani reverberated in seats of power across the globe. That was their take on it. And really, it didn't. It didn't at all. Because basically what we've, you know, if you could go back to 2013 and look at Rouhani's win back then after Ahmadinejad had run his two terms, so he couldn't run again. That's exactly what the media was saying back then. It's exactly the same statements, that this is going to change Iran, that this is a positive development, that Iran is going to move into that Rouhani is going to take Iran into a different direction, away from some of the hardline tactics of Ahmadinejad. And yet, 4 years later, I mean, the Iran that we see right now is, I mean, anyone can look at world news and just see news out of the Middle East. And Iran hasn't become closer to the West. Iran, well, although it has, you know, some of the sanctions have gone down, some trade has come in, they are still continuing their march across the Middle East. They're still pumping funds into Syria, Yemen, trying to destabilize those nations to ensure that it can have control. Their budget in the past year has, I think, doubled, military budget, sorry. So they might have more money, but they're directing it, this windfall, into their military. And so I don't know how these media outlets can state so positively that this is a blow to Iran's conservatives. I mean, the conservative, arch conservative, is the Ayatollah. He's still the supreme leader. Nothing has changed in that regard. And he is very happy with the last 4 years of Rouhani's term. Mr. Netanyahu, when he was appearing before the UN a few years ago, he labeled Mr. Rouhani as a wolf in sheep's clothing. He's still a wolf. Ahmadinejad, he said, was a wolf in wolf's clothing. Rouhani's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And that's what we've seen for the past 4 years. So why would we expect any change now?
So Rouhani is credited with doing a lot to make that nuclear deal with the United States and the other Western powers possible. Do you think that deal would have happened if Ahmadinejad or another, wolf in wolf's clothing had still been in power?
I think it would have, just because that was a lie. That was that this nuclear deal was predicated upon the election of Rouhani. That's what the Obama administration put out. That has since come out that negotiations for the nuclear deal actually started before Rouhani was even in power. But they sold that narrative that now that we have a moderate in there, let's push forward with closer relations. A nuclear deal would be a great way to show that was happening, because the president. President Obama wanted that. President Obama wanted his closer relations with Iran. And what I thought was just so interesting this past Saturday, I mean, you had an election that Iran wanted to show the world that they are still on the path towards moderation. At least put that out there, let people think that. And yet President Trump was in Saudi Arabia. He was talking to the Saudis and 50 other different Middle Eastern and Muslim nations, talking about how horrible Iran is, what they're doing for terrorism, how they're corrupting the Middle East and spreading jihad across the Middle East, basically. And nobody really heard about the election, just because Mr. Trump was there trumpeting that it does not matter who is in power in Iran. The Ayatollah is still in power, and they're going to continue with the Islamic revolution and exporting that as much as they can.
One more quick question here. You mentioned that in many ways, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini is the actual power. Rouhani and anyone else is essentially a puppet beneath him. I've read reports recently saying that Khomeini's health is apparently failing quickly. I just wonder if you know if there's legitimacy to those reports, and if he were to die, would you expect any meaningful changes to take place in Iran?
I don't think so, no. Everyone that's in politics in Iran now has already been vetted through years of service, that they all agree that the Islamic revolution is the way to go, mm-hmm. all their leaders. And while I think it might be true that Khamenei's health is in doubt, the guy that's lining up to potentially be the next supreme leader is the hardliner, so-called, that just lost to Rouhani. Hmm. So Raisi, he was the arch conservative that was going up against Rouhani, and he lost the election. Some are saying it's great that he lost the election because now he can become the supreme leader, which would put just somebody in the mold of Khamenei in that more important role in the future. So there's no turning back. Mm-hmm. I mean, the time that we could have turned back from this was back in 2009 with the Green Revolution.
Right.
That's when there was. Protests on the streets. That's when the United States failed to help out those protests that wanted to see an end to the Islamic regime. And one of the guys that was there that was trying to stop those protests was none other than Rouhani, the so-called moderate. He doesn't want an end to the Islamic revolution, the president that just got elected.
So Iran's direction at this point is bigger than any one man and pretty much past the point of no return. Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about the devastating terrorist attack that hit the UK this week, how the American press's handling of that attack is putting strains on the UK-US relationship. We'll also discuss new strains in America's relationship with the Philippines and the new leader in Hamas. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. On Monday night, Britain suffered its most devastating terrorist attack in more than a decade. A suicide bomber killed 22 people and injured 116 when he detonated an explosive at one of the main exits in one of Europe's biggest concert venues. This was just such a barbaric attack, targeting mostly young girls who were there to watch the concert. And to tell us about this development and why this keeps on happening and what to make of it, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
So we're confronted with yet another terrorist attack within Europe, and yet another one with really, a really large number of casualties and injured. One article I read made the point that we used to know these days by their day, know these attacks by their days. There was 9/11 for those of us in Britain. 7/7 was 7th of July, mm-hmm. where there was the big London bombings. Everyone knows what that means when you just say 7/7, and now you've just got this increasing pace of attacks. And so this is just yet another in a long chain of attacks with just very large numbers of people affected. I think it was something like 50 that were injured, and then it's just especially kind of a heart-wrenching attack. I remember just going on Twitter the next day and not only do you have the numbers, but then you have a vast number more of parents looking for their teens that have gone off to this concert by themselves. You just see all of these tweets from various different parents. You know, my 12-year-old girl, she was off at this concert. I've not seen her since. Has anyone seen her? I don't know if she's dead or alive. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's an attack that has really, I think, rocked the psyche of the nation.
So Britain, as you mentioned, is no stranger to terror attacks, but this is the largest since 2005. What are you seeing so far from the Prime Minister and from the people, and how do we expect Britain to react here?
Yeah, I think we're seeing two kind of almost divergent trends. I think on the one hand, you're seeing the repetition of exactly the same platitudes that we've always seen. Mm-hmm. Mr. Flory quoted on the Trumpet Daily radio show from a Telegraph article columnist who was basically saying, well, we should just treat this the same way we would treat a train crash or a train accident. And, wow. You know, we should maybe, the Prime Minister should maybe have a meeting for an hour or so and try and work out, okay, well, what exactly went wrong? How do we make sure there's not another train crash in the future? And then we should just kind of move on. And there definitely are a lot of people responding like that. There are a lot of, how could we understand what would make someone do this and all of these, this kind of reaction. But I think because the target was teenage girls, there is also a stronger element of, okay, well, actually, we need to do something. Mm-hmm. I saw a clip from Andrew Neil, who presents a very prominent news show, and his kind of monologues have gone viral in the past after these terrorist attacks, where he's just really gone to town against the terrorist attacks and against the attackers and condemned them in blistering terms. And at the start of this one, he kind of said, well, I know so a lot of you are probably hoping I'm going to do something similar today, but I'm not. We keep saying this. We keep having these clips that go viral of people criticizing the attackers. Yes, of course, we can pay tribute to our emergency services. Yes, of course, we can do this and say that, and it needs to be said. But what can we do? What can the government change? We're in the middle of an election campaign. Can our politicians give us a solution, please? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's much more of a sense of we need to do something differently. Now, I'm definitely not saying that's the majority, but I'm saying you saw almost nothing like that after the London attacks, and now you're seeing some of that. And I think really you see two, in terms of what we're watching from Bible prophecy, you see two kind of overlapping trends here, because when we're talking about Britain as kind of geographically part of Europe, we tend to talk about the way that Britain is soft on terrorism and not doing anything about it. And then we talk about how Europe is eventually going to respond and how Europe is eventually going to crack down on terrorism. But you see some of both aspects in both. You see a lot of Europe behaving the same way that we expect Britain to basically keep on behaving,
right?
Where, let's not do anything. We'll talk platitudes and kind of hope it goes away. And so I think it's logical to expect a certain amount of the same response that we know from Bible prophecy is going to come from Europe. I think it's logical to expect a certain amount of that from Britain as well, as they're caught up in the same trends and people respond respond in the same way. Now, ultimately, we know that it's Europe that's going to have the strong response and not Britain. And probably these voices that are saying, well, something needs to change are going to remain in the minority. But I think it is interesting that you are seeing, and notable, that people really, that these attacks are just coming so often that they are starting to get more desperate for a real solution.
In the first half, we spoke about President Trump pressuring the heads of NATO nations to start spending more on defense. And as part of that pressure, Mr. Trump said that more attacks, like the Manchester bombing, will happen unless NATO does more to stop jihadists. Do you think there's validity to that, or are these kinds of terror attacks less a military question and more of a kind of an internal security question for European nations?
Well, firstly, I don't think anyone can dispute that more attacks are coming unless something is done mm-hmm. to stop them. I think just about everyone agrees on that, and even the ones that are kind of soft say, well, we just have to put up with this. I think your main question was about, well, whether is this about policing or is this about a military response? is an interesting one. I think I think ultimately it's got to be both. And I think if terrorists have an external base that they can plan and train and move in from, they're always going to be a problem. Even if you have perfect solution, a perfect policing, if you have people from the outside, they're going to be able to keep coming in. At the same time, even if you had an external military solution, but imperfect policing and just let things fester from within, then you're going to get terrorist attacks. And you've seen some of these terrorists, they've lived in the country for a generation or two, and they launched these attacks. So really, the solution has got to encompass both. And again, from Bible prophecy, that's what we expect. We expect a Europe that cracks down much harder on civil liberties at home, and confronting terrorism may well be a part of that. And at the same time, one that gets much more involved in the Middle East and going out there and taking care of that problem. So I think that's a way a lot of, and really going a lot further than taking care of that problem, but I think that's a way a lot of experts would see. You need both components to deal with that. And I think we can expect both components from Europe.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. One troubling event in the aftermath of that Manchester attack was the American press obtaining some leaked information that was apparently confidential British intelligence, and some U.S. publications apparently published it. And some say that this could seriously compromise parts of the ongoing investigations. So this breach could end up translating into quite a blow to the U.S.-UK relationship. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this has been for pretty much the last all of this year, there's been a huge problem with like confidential information leaking from U.S. intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. And it's actually for about a 24-hour period or a little less than 24-hour period this week, several key British police departments actually stopped sharing intelligence with the United States because of one of these leaks. Wow. Obviously, after the Manchester terrorist attack, the Manchester Police Department and maybe a couple other British intelligence agencies shared some of the information with the FBI here in the United States, and within 5 hours of them sharing it, there were some key details that had leaked to the New York Times, including the terrorist name, some pictures of his backpack, and even a diagram of like where the victims had been killed.
Wow.
And so obviously the British police departments weren't too amused at the fact that they'd given this information confidentially to the FBI, and it was in the hands of the New York Times within 5 hours. Shut down information sharing with the United States until British Prime Minister Theresa May confronted President Trump about it. Shortly after that, and obviously this has been a struggle President Trump's been dealing with since he's been president. And so he vowed to crack down and do everything he can to find this leaker. Those police departments, they have resumed the intelligence sharing. But it's really significant because it comes right on the heels of just, I think, when last week's program we talked about President Trump sharing some information about ISIS strongholds in Syria with some of his Russian counterparts.
Right.
And that information was leaked to the Washington Post within hours of him having that conversation. And they tried to make it a big deal, like, oh, the president leaked classified information. And like, well, technically there's no such thing as classified information for the president, because who's going to tell him what's classified and what's not?
Right.
But he's the head of the executive branch of government. But obviously, whoever told the Washington Post, they definitely leaked classified information that could endanger intelligence officers' lives around the world. And so, and that's just two high-ranking examples from the past 2 weeks. But for a couple months now, you've really just had this to where President Trump, he can't even trust his own or at least that's the thought, is that he can't even trust his own inner circle, his own intelligence agencies, as there's almost like this, almost like civil war levels. I mean, not actual violence, but like civil war level conflicts between the Trump administration and the intelligence agencies he's just taken over.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. Ever since he became president of the Philippines in June of last year, Mr. Rodrigo Duterte has injected a lot of uncertainty into the question of Manila's allegiances and the Philippines' intended geopolitical direction. He's worried many in the United States with his threats on several different occasions to sever ties with the U.S. and to instead partner up with China or Russia. And this week, Mr. Duterte fired a fresh volley of these threats. And to tell us about this, we'll go once again to Kieran Under.
Rodrigo Duterte just went on his planned five-day visit to Russia, and before that trip, he had a number of interviews, and then when he got there, he did a number of interviews with Russia Today. But during that trip, he actually had to go home, go back to the Philippines, which is also interesting, and we'll talk about that. But before, some of the comments that he said were just really indicative of what all the trends that it's been that his previous comments have been leading up to. I'll give you a couple of them here. He just says, "I don't want anything to do with the U.S." This was the interview before he went to Russia. "And I want them to stop telling me what to do." He says he doesn't like America giving him these conditions for their in order to get the benefits. He says America, since the end of the 1960s, has been interfering with other states. They offer a country help, but in demand, they demand in exchange that the country adopt certain laws, for example, to legalize homosexual marriages. So what he really doesn't like here is the fact that he needs to deliver on some of the promises that President Obama or President Trump wants him to do in order to get these benefits. But instead of accepting those compromises, he's instead saying that he would just go to Russia instead. And the reason is because Russia doesn't ask questions. He recalls this story where a Russian diplomat told him in 2016, "Come to Russia. We have here anything you need." And he was trying to get a number of weapons in his fight against terrorism. And the Americans had just told him, "No, we're not giving it to you because of your human rights abuses." And this Russian diplomat said, "Well, come here. Come to Russia. We'll give you the weapons. And we won't ask any questions." And that's why Duterte likes the Russians.
Well, we've heard Mr. Duterte threaten this type of thing several times before, to part ways with America and to partner up with either China or Russia. But he doesn't wield total power in the Philippines by any means, even with his declaration of limited martial law this week. And the top brass in the military, who seem to, you know, possibly have more actual power than Duterte does in some ways, they always seem to remind him that Manila's alliance with the U.S. is not really something that's actually up for negotiation. So what are your thoughts about Mr. Duterte's actual ability to end the U.S.-Philippines alliance?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how much influence he has over the people. If you continually get this message, I was listening to a few of his interviews with Russia Today, him talking about the hypocrisy of the United States, going into other countries, trying to force them to do what they want, whether or not you believe in that as a Westerner. But if you have that message continually going on, you're going to have a few more people coming over to his side. I know the last statistics that I looked at, I think the Filipinos still viewed, around 92% of the Filipinos still viewed America favorably. So overwhelmingly, people in the Philippines still like America.
Yeah, more than Americans like America, even, according to those polls.
Yeah, so the public definitely is fond of the Americans. It's just whether or not that rhetoric or that opinion can be changed with Duterte's rhetoric, and whether or not it's just more practical to get some of the things that they can't get from America because they're getting refused, to just go to China and to Russia instead, and just starting that transition. Because, of course, Duterte doesn't right now have the ability to just switch from one to the other, just totally cut off contact with the United States. But he does want to transition.
Well, thanks very much for that, Kieran. Well, a new leader was recently appointed over Hamas, which is the largest of several Palestinian militant groups, and Iran has wasted no time at all in congratulating this leader and urging him to intensify the push against Israel, the push to liberate Palestine, as they see it. And to bring us up to speed on this development, we'll go once again to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so there are some interesting times with Hamas. They have had a new leader over the Gaza Strip. Yahya Sinwar, he was elected, I believe, or chosen, I believe, a couple of months ago. And then the head of Hamas that's currently out of the country or out of the territory, Ismail Haniyeh, he was elected to that position over the terrorist group itself. And what's interesting about this is over the past few years, Hamas has actually the relationship with Hamas and Iran has actually cooled quite a lot, because Hamas was not supportive of what was going on in Syria by the Syrian regime and the Syrian regime's an Iranian ally. So Iran decided to stop giving them funds. And that meant Hamas had to look out for other benefactors to fund their terrorism. But what it seems now with these two elections of these two figures, Yahya Sinwar and also Haniyeh, is that they are becoming back in favor with Iran. And Qassem Soleimani, he's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds force, their extra outside Iran's force whenever they want to do anything outside Iran. He's the guy that gets called up, this Qassem Soleimani, probably the most popular. Well, he's definitely the most popular general in Iran. I would say he's probably the second or third most powerful man in Iran. And he's lauded as a hero. And he's coming out saying this is wonderful that we have Haniyeh now, the head of Hamas. And we look forward to working together with you to undermine undermine the Jews and stop the arrogant power being America. And so what we're seeing here, I think, is with these two elections and plus what Soleimani is saying, is a closening or a strengthening of that relationship that had become cool over the past 2 years between Hamas and Iran.
Do you know what the difference is between these new Hamas leaders and the ones that they replace that is making Iran suddenly warmer toward them?
Well, it looks like there was some internal division over the past probably 6 or 7 months inside Hamas itself. And some of these, there were certain in the Hamas faction that didn't want to be so beholden to Iran. And yet what's bubbled to the surface are very pro or very militaristic leaders, and also very pro-Iran. These two leaders have a history of a strong relationship with Iran. So these are the two positions where this is noticeable. But there has been a gutting of Hamas's leadership wholesale to follow along with those that would conform to Iranian leadership.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit there to read more about the stories we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and also our news brief, which we send out several times each week. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. And we went a little bit over in the previous segments, so this will be an even briefer lightning round than usual. First of all, we will go to Andrew Miller.
A recent Bankrate.com survey found that nearly three-quarters of Americans have financial regrets. And the biggest of those regrets was not starting early enough to save for retirement. Of those Americans surveyed, 18% said their biggest financial mistake was not starting early enough to save for retirement. And close behind at 13% was not saving enough for emergency expenses.
And now we'll go to Brent.
Some 78% of Israelis believe there is no chance of reaching a peace agreement with the Palestinians. That's according to a poll taken yesterday. Even among Israelis who define themselves as left-wing, only 21% said a peace agreement is possible. This poll indicates that while the Israelis appreciate Mr. Trump's efforts to restore the Israeli-United States relationship, Israelis don't believe that he'll be able to be successful in his desire to negotiate a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians.
And Richard.
Also yesterday, Donald Trump told Germans they were behaving very badly because they were exporting too many cars. He threatened to impose, again, big tariffs on German exports, and Germany's economy is 50% export, so that's quite a dramatic threat, and it will make a difference in German-American relations.
For our final item, we'll go to Kieran Underwood.
Taiwan's Constitutional Court legalized homosexual marriage on Wednesday. The justices called sexual orientation an immutable characteristic that is resistant to change. And the Taiwanese legislature has 2 years to pass new laws.
Thanks for that, Kieran. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our print edition and our Trumpet Brief. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Kieran Underwood, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks very much.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And in recognition of the Memorial Day weekend that we're now entering into here in the United States, I'll leave you today with some relevant words from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. They are dead, but they live in each patriot's breast, and their names are engraven on honor's bright crest. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a real pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.